Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's a Sunday evening here in lovely Skopje, Macedonia. My central heating has been restored. I am full of anti-flu medication, and I am therefore overjoyed, euphoric. And of course, I'm very happy to welcome Dr. Mark Weber of the Institute for Historical Review, who is here with us to discuss something which has been at the back and the front of my mind for some time now, which is what I like to call the Nuremberg moral paradigm. But Dr. Weber, please introduce yourself for the audience who may be living under a rock. Who knows?
I was born and raised in Portland, Oregon. I have a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. I do not have a doctoral degree, so your doctor is
it's an honorific. Nice. I'm honoring an elder.
Right. I was on a doctoral program, but I decided not to continue with that. I went to universities in the United States, but also a year at the University of Munich in Germany. I lived in Germany for 2.5 years and traveled quite a lot over Europe. I've done a great deal of research over the years in Washington, D.C. I lived there for 5 years. I might even have reason to mention that specifically with regard to the Nuremberg trial discussion that we're engaged in. And I, since 1991, I've been working for the Institute for Historical Review. I came here first on a kind of lowly basis, that's all changed over time, and now I'm essentially the main person here carrying out this work, which I think is important, and it really raises the larger question of the relationship of history to how we view our times and view the future. I think it's especially important because Americans like to think that history doesn't matter very much. In fact, Americans in particular have a tendency to think that unlike other countries, which are retarded and held back by the heavy hand of history, Americans just move and look forward to the future. We just get the job done. We don't worry about what happened in the past. We just go on. I think that that's, and as long as America was sort of on top of the world, especially after World War II in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, that was, it led to and supported a kind of arrogance that we know all the answers. Our country's really tops, we're good. That's changing. It's changing in part because we're going through a tremendous period right now of historical revisionism in the United States and in Europe too, to a lesser extent, but certainly in the United States. Leaders of the country who have been honored for more than a century or two centuries are now reviled, held in contempt for holding views that are so crassly different than the ones everyone's supposed to hold today. So the statues of Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, and their place in history has been radically changed. And there's been a very dramatic rewriting of American history in this country to fit with the current fashion of what we're supposed to all think. And that brings us to why I think what we're doing is important. I mean, all history and history writing is, in a sense, revisionist in that historians keep on writing about history because they try to take into account, first of all, new perspectives based upon the outlook that people have, and also new evidence as it arises, or people become more aware of new evidence. And so history is, if there was not any historical revisionism, we wouldn't even be continuing to write about history, but we do. And in fact, right now, there's an enormous amount of writing about, especially American history here in the United States. But to go to your point, the Nuremberg moral paradigm, the Nuremberg trials, and we're talking especially about the main Nuremberg trial. It's called the International Military Tribunal. It operated from the end of 1945 into 1946. It was carried out, as the name suggests, in Nuremberg, and it was organized, headed, presided over by the victorious powers of the Second World War, especially the United States, the Soviet Union, Britain, France had a place in the trials, but France was really not any kind of big power at that time. It was more of a courtesy to France. But essentially, it was really run by the United States and the Soviet Union, first and foremost, and by Britain. And out of that has come, as you say, this moral paradigm that this enormous judicial enterprise supposedly confirmed that the Allied powers in the Second World War were the good guys and that the defeated Germans were the bad guys. They weren't just merely rapacious and aggressive. They were evil. They were really, really bad. And the goodness, you might say, of the Allied cause in the Second World War was supposedly confirmed by the Nuremberg judgment. I mean, I think that many younger people don't really appreciate just how huge and important an enterprise this was. It was by far the most important judicial undertaking, most important trial, you might say, certainly of the 20th century. Probably it was given more publicity than any trial or judicial proceeding in all of history. But certainly it's been very, very important, cited all many numerous times, enshrined in motion pictures, documentaries, and so forth, that the Nuremberg trials are really good because they really put the stamp on the goodness and righteousness of the Allied cause and really showed how bad the defeated German leaders were. And as a result, German leaders, most of them were, of course, punished. Several most important ones were executed, put to death. But there's an enormous gap between what the public sort of knows or hears about the Nuremberg trials on the one hand, and what historians of any serious nature really understand about the Nuremberg trials on the others. And there's some enormous defects to the whole Nuremberg enterprise that most people are just not aware of, because most people want their history served in very neat blocks and very easy to understand ways. And we'll get into some of the details of why the Nuremberg process is enormously hypocritical, an example of a tremendous double standard. But there's something before I get into it, just to put the Nuremberg trial in a kind of context that many people might find surprising. When I was doing research on aspects of the Nuremberg trial and going through the records and so forth in Washington, I had conversations with archivists at the National Archives, and the person who was responsible or in charge supervisor of the what they call the captured German records section, you could say stolen records, but anyway, the captured German records section, was a man named Robert Wolf, who in fact was Jewish. And I had numerous conversations with him, and he pointed out something to me that struck me at the time as surprising, and I think it's important to remember. He said to me, remember, the Nuremberg trials were not set up to show the Germans were bad because they killed 6 million Jews. They were set up primarily, overwhelmingly, to show that the German leaders were responsible for starting the Second World War. And that's important because today, in the United States, in Europe, around the world, what we now call the Holocaust has come to play this enormously important role in how we look at the Second World War and the Nuremberg trials. And it's important to realize that's not how people looked at things during the war and in the years after the war. The very word Holocaust, to refer to killing, oppression, whatever, of Jews during the war, didn't come into popular usage in the United States until the late 1970s and early 1980s.
I'm reading right now. I'm reading a book by Numa Fustel de Coulanges, I think his name is, who wrote about the ancient city, and there's just a throwaway line in which he refers to burnt offerings, which the Romans, the Greeks, and the Hindus to this day offer, and he just calls them holocausts. And this is a book written in the 19th century. So up until then, I mean, the Holocaust just meant sacrifice by fire, a burnt offering. This was not a controversial word.
Right. Well, the use of the term Holocaust as an overarching term to apply to killing or oppression, whatever, of Jews in the Second World War, as I mentioned, didn't even come into really popular usage until the 1970s. And it was part of a concerted campaign. I won't go into details about that now. But the point is, today, it's considered a crime in many countries, something called Holocaust denial is a crime. If somebody in 1960 had said we should make Holocaust denial a crime, people wouldn't know what you're talking about. That alone ought to raise questions, because to make something a crime that just a few years earlier, people wouldn't even have known what you're talking about is already a pretty astonishing thing. But Holocaust denial, as they call it, is treated as a crime, as a thought crime in a number of European countries, and almost that way here in the United States. I mean, people will be severely punished, not legally or judicially, but they will be in their jobs and so forth.
The American government is notorious for outsourcing its oppressions to the private sector. So you could say that many of the things which are de jure illegal in Europe are only de facto illegal in America. Right. However, ultimately it is the de facto that counts.
Yes.
We have, I'm sorry, I know you're on a wonderful train of thought, Mr. Weber or Dr. Weber. I'm going to stick with Dr. Weber because I like the sound of it, but I do have some crass financial issues to take care of. First of all, I want to thank the sponsors of the Writer's Block, Alaska Chaga Tea, for providing us with our favorite beverage on this show. Although this is not Alaska Chaga, I was not able to prepare Alaska Chaga today for reasons I'm not going to get into. Still, yours is a wonderful product, and I will be drinking it as soon as I can. And of course, Alaska Chaga has donated a Ninja Gini on DLive, and Slog has donated 14 lemons. And that's something we greatly appreciate. And people, you are watching the Writer's Block. And of course, you can always send us questions, donations, and you can even send us your hurtful comments and remarks on Entropy. I love it when people pay to insult me. It gives me a sense of power over them. But I called you here, Dr. Weber. I called you on the Writer's Block because there was something that's been nagging at me, right? Very often, I too am very interested in revisionist history. Sometimes, you know, purely as a form of academic pleasure, because I like a good story, you know. Sometimes because I consider it essential to building, well, political power, essentially, political coalition, to discovering ways in which we can and should act. And of course, I'm a European, so history actually weighs down very heavy on me. When you were talking about how Americans like to ignore history, let me just say that I understand the temptation, because when you are like me and like other Europeans, born in Europe, and you're taught about all of the things that your ancestors did, all of the things that happened, and you realize I'm not the first and I'm not the last person here. Someone said that in Europe, every particle of dirt has passed through 1,000 human bodies, and you can feel it when you're in Europe. Like, I was thinking about this when I drive through the city, I drive around a Turkish fort, which was built on a Byzantine fort, which was built on a Roman fort. And I just drive around it like there's nothing there, but it weighs down on the city and no escaping it. And every Macedonian lives in the shadow of Alexander, or, you know, maybe you have a glimmer of hope of standing on his shoulders instead of living in his shadows, in his shadow. But it is what it is. And I understand this temptation to ignore history, because it does weigh on people. However, there's another argument I've heard that, sure, we can go for revisionist history. Sure, it's fun. Sure, it could hypothetically help us discover things. And of course, pursuing the truth, that's its own reward, right? But if it's politically inopportune And therefore, even if we are right, why should we do this thing, right? Why should we expose ourselves to prosecution, which will inevitably come if we earnestly engage in revisionist history? So would you care to comment on that? Would you care to give a response to this question? Why should we do it when we know it's going to bring down the hammer of the enemy upon us?
Well, there, I think looking at history is important, and that means, well, truthful history, history that's in accord with reality, and is important really in both a larger way and a more narrow way. The larger way is to understand history, and I mean going back not just 50 years or 500 years, but 2,000 years, is to understand that the essential nature of human beings is the same. Human beings are still human beings, and we can flatter ourselves that we're more enlightened, that we're smarter, that we're better than our ancestors. But this is especially true in the modern age because we have all these gadgets and technical miracles that give many people the illusion that we're better people because we have all sorts of, we have cell phones and computers, and we're able to talk as we are across the oceans in a way that our ancestors didn't. And so there's this tendency to think, well, we're really superior to our ancestors, but we're still human beings. And when a society, when any society begins to think that it can live outside the reality of history, and really what this means is outside of the nature of human beings, it's doomed. But on a concrete level, the United States and Western Europe today are both trying to create a kind of society based on an egalitarian, universalist worldview, a so-called liberal democratic society that is ahistorical, non-historical. It will not work. It will not succeed because it does not take into account the essential nature of human beings. Human beings are not just replaceable consumer or units. We are human beings, and that human beings are essentially also not just individuals, but social beings. And our social nature means that we live in groups. We live in tribes or nations or families. If we don't, if we deny that, any society trying to live in opposition to that reality is doomed. And we can see all around us now the consequences of that. I think it's more and more obvious to everyone that American-style democracy, liberal democracy, whatever you call it, is in a crisis. It's falling apart. Just the other day, there was a column by a major writer for the New York Times, says America's falling apart at the seams. That was the headline. It's actually mixing metaphors. And he says, well, you can see the signs of this all around. There was a poll last year that showed that 78% of Democrats, 83% of Republicans think the country, the United States, is falling apart. In Europe today, everyone can see that Europe is becoming inexorably, more rapidly, a third world kind of society. Things are not working. And this is directly a result of denying, you might say, history, denying the reality of human beings. Now, that's the larger reason why understanding history is important, because we can learn about people and how they live and how they can live, what the possibilities are by understanding the sweep of history. That's on the larger scale. On the narrower scale, the world we live in today, when I say the world, I mean Western Europe and the United States, is very largely the result of the outcome of the Second World War. The Second World War was the triumph of the United States and the Soviet Union above all. And not just the triumph of two countries, but two nations which had their own versions of a universalist society, an egalitarian society, a new kind of society. The United States in the Second World War wasn't fighting just to knock down the bad guys. The United States leaders and government proclaimed that it was going to build a new world order in cooperation with the Soviet Union, in which war wouldn't exist anymore. in which there would be a new world order free of even want and fear. That's what America proclaimed. These are utopian goals, and every effort in human history to create a society based on a utopian or not unrealistic ideal is doomed. It cannot succeed. And that's essentially what Western Europe and the United States are trying to do today. And that outlook came out of the Second World War. The Soviet version of this universalist utopia has failed. And the American or liberal democratic idea of this universalist new age, new world order is also, I think, ever more obviously failing even by its own measure. And understanding that, putting that in that kind of context is important. The way to understand that or put it in context is by understanding how is it that this worldview that most people are not only accept, but are forced to accept, obliged to accept, how did that get in place? It came in place out of the Second World War. And a major, you might say, propaganda prop for this world we live in today was the Nuremberg Tribunal of 1945-1946. It's a very important part of that. Now, of course, it's less important now than it was at the time, and I'm sure, confident, that many younger people have only a rather dim idea about what Nuremberg and the Nuremberg Tribunal was all about. They just merely know that, well, the worldview that we're all supposed to hold today, and that any deviation of it is considered really bad, it's probably fascism or oppression or something bad, is now so ingrained in our mass media and so forth that many, especially younger people, have a hard time envisioning how this got in place and how this happened. And that's why understanding the Nuremberg Tribunal is important, because it played a major role in solidifying this outlook, this worldview that is now the prevailing one in the United States and Western Europe, and is the basis for the policies that have been in place for these years and have led to the crisis, the catastrophe that we're all seeing around us in the Western Europe and the United States today.
Right. That's the interesting thing. I call it the Nuremberg moral paradigm, but it's not just a moral paradigm. It is a legal paradigm as well, and we see it in the laws on the books in a lot of European countries, not just in Western Europe, also in Eastern Europe, because let's not forget that Eastern Europe, Russia, the Soviet bloc, and even, you know, the non-aligned countries such as Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia, they also existed within the post-Nuremberg paradigm, having imposed it upon Germany and the rest of the world and upon themselves. This is something that's I usually have to point out to viewers in the West, that they seem to think that here in Eastern Europe, things are not as bad from the aspect of because things are not as bad from the demographic aspect, that it's somehow a right-wing utopia. The reality is, it's not. It's not. People here were brainwashed for 80 years with egalitarian propaganda from the communists, and it's just so endemic in the culture, in the legal system. Again, this is enshrined in law in many places in Eastern Europe, that all we really are missing are the migrants and, let's say, the vast hordes of non-whites. And we are only missing them because we are relatively poorer than the West, because the West can offer better, it has a better social safety net, which these migrants can then abuse. That is the only difference. Our societies here in Eastern Europe are likewise very strongly poisoned by egalitarianism. But okay, so the response to everything you said, Dr. Weber, is, well, of course, yeah, the Nuremberg trials may have been a public relations prop, but the Germans did commit crimes, right? I mean, they were committing, oh, of course they did, the Holocaust. This is something you cannot even legally deny in some places. And this whole notion that the Germans waged a legal war, they conducted bombings of civilian populations, which the Allies also did, and all of the other sundry crimes with which the German high command was accused at Nuremberg. But I read the two-part treatise on Nuremberg at the Institute of Historical Review, and I was simply astounded at the degree of lying, the scope and the scale of the lie. I don't often let emotion get into my activism and my scholarship as a dissident rightist, but this time I was, you could say I was flabbergasted just by the depth, the scope, and the endurance of the lie, that it could go on for 80 years, and you can't hear any alternative stories unless you turn to this very specific niche place of the internet, to places like the IHR or maybe countercurrents.com for these ideas. Would you care to get into that? Just the simple right. facts right. Of what went on, what the lie that gave birth to Nuremberg.
Well, there's lots of specifics which I would am glad to get into, but the essential injustice of the Nuremberg Tribunal is twofold. First, that the prosecutors, the judges of the Nuremberg Tribunal were selected by the same people. It was all an allied government operation. And that means it was one-sided. The only crimes, quote unquote, that were under review were those committed by the defendants. There was any effort, any attempt to show that similar or the same actions were carried out by the allies was immediately quashed. That was just not permitted. Repeatedly, the judges would remind witnesses or remind the defense attorneys that allied behavior in the trial is just not even going to be discussed. So that essentially, it's like saying we're going to make it a crime to, we're going to arrest somebody, and because he has blue eyes, we're going to make it a crime that everybody with blue eyes is a bad person. Well, if you, the blue-eyed person could just easily say, well, other people do this, and they say, we don't care. We're only going to apply it in a selective way. So essentially, it was completely one-sided in that way. Only the actions of the defendants were under review. It didn't matter if other people, if the allied side did the same thing. That was one thing. Secondly, the Nuremberg Tribunal is an example of what they call ex post facto law. Laws were created for the occasion. Actions that were not illegal before Nuremberg were now declared legal, or they were also actions, of course, as I mentioned earlier, carried out by the Germans. Those are bad. Those are crimes, even if the Allies did it. So they're essentially, just fundamentally, the Nuremberg Tribunal was unjust because it's selective so-called justice. And justice applied selectively isn't a form of justice, it's a form of injustice. And that's the essential thing. Now, specifically, many of the charges made against the defendants were either, there was no basis for them, they're a perversion of the reality, or they were actions that the Allies themselves. I mean, one example, in citing how the German leaders were guilty of aggressive war, of planning war, they said that the German aggression against Britain and France began on September 3rd, 1939. Well, on September 3rd, 1939, it wasn't Germany that attacked Britain and France. It was Britain and France that declared war against Germany, much to the chagrin, much to the shock of the German leaders that Britain and France did declare war. They thought that there was no vital interest of France or Britain to declare war, but they did. But the British and French declaration of war against the Germans was cited by the Nuremberg Tribunal as an example of German aggression. There's many examples like this. The Germans were held to be responsible for aggressive war in occupying Norway in 1940. Well, the Germans only occupied Norway because the British had already mined Norwegian waters and were themselves underway to occupy Norway themselves. The German forces beat the British forces by only a matter of hours in occupying Norway. They did so. Hitler didn't want, he wanted Norway to be neutral. Norway was a transit point for providing iron ore from Sweden that was then shipped to Germany. And Hitler was quite happy. The German leaders were quite happy with that arrangement. But Britain didn't want that. And so it first developed plans to invade Norway to keep iron ore from Sweden from going to Germany. Germany only occupied Norway to forestall that. That's another example. Another one is that the Germans were guilty of attacking another country, aggression, and that's really a bad thing. Although the Allies never really defined aggression. In August 1941, British and Soviet forces invaded and occupied Iran, a neutral country. This was completely illegal. It led to the deaths of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in Iran. But that wasn't a crime. That
What
was okay.
bearing did it really have on the any point of the conflict? When you think about the Second World War, when you think about the fronts where they are in the Pacific theater, the African theater, the European theater, where does Iran even figure into all of this? Or were the British and Soviets just thirsting for the oil and other resources of Iran?
It's because Iran was an important source of oil for the British. Iran was neutral. It wanted to stay out of the war. There was an understanding by the British and the Soviets, and even earlier by the Russians, that Iran was going to be divided in their spheres of influence, and that's what they did. And it was also important as a supply chain a link for supplying American and especially British aid to the Soviet Union through Iran. That was another reason. But it did it for its own reasons, of course, in the war. The British occupied Iceland in 1940. That was illegal too. Iceland was part of Denmark. And then American troops actually replaced the British troops in occupying Iceland in 1941, also completely illegal. The United States was supposedly a neutral country. I mean, there's so many examples of this that it's a perversion. Another example is that the Germans were accused of starting bombings of civilians. Well, the first country to really proclaim and set out a policy of bombing civilians in order to just kill civilians to shatter morale of the enemy forces of the other side were the British. And this is borne out by numerous documents. This was even admitted by British officials. It's terror, really. It's a form of terror. But the
And this
Germans
was also done by the Soviets in Finland as early as 1940 during the Winter War.
right.
In
Winter
fact, this is
War
the
of 19
origin of the notorious Molotov cocktail. You
right.
see, when the Soviets were bombing Helsinki and other Finnish cities, Molotov, who was premier of the Soviet Union at the time, he came out and said, "No, we're just dropping bread baskets." And so when the Finnish invented the Molotov cocktail, they said, "This is something to wash that bread down with." And they used it to great effect in the Winter War. Pro tip, tanks don't function well against well being enveloped in fire.
Right.
But do carry on.
I mean, the Soviet Union invaded Finland in 1939. Finland, I mean, the Soviet Union was actually expelled from the League of Nations for this act of aggression. But at Nuremberg, this was, of course, completely ignored. I mean, the Soviet Union had attacked Romania, took parts of Romania, it took the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania in 1940. All of this, and they were absorbed. They weren't just attacked, they were actually absorbed within the Soviet Union. In 1939, the Germans attacked Poland on September 1st. That's dated by many people as the beginning of World War II. It's actually not true, but that's another point. And then 6 weeks later, several weeks later, the Soviet Union attacked Poland. But only the German attack against Poland was considered aggression or a conspiracy for war. I mean, there's so many examples. One of the defendants at Nuremberg was Rudolf Hess. Rudolf Hess was the only important figure of any country during the Second World War to risk his life to try to end the war. He flew in 1941 in May in his own kind of reckless personal crusade to try to at least end the war between Britain and Germany, and he was treated as a prisoner of war. He was never involved in any conferences about war. He had nothing to do with military policy, and yet he was put on trial as a war criminal. Alone, the treatment of Rudolf Hess, who was the one person who had tried at the risk of his own life to end the war, was treated as a war criminal. Years later, when he finally died, the Wiesenthal Center, which is considered a very important center of enlightenment in American society, said that it doesn't matter about any of that. He, in 1935, signed the Nuremberg Laws, and that alone was a reason to put him to death. That means he's a bad guy. The point of all of this is not to say that on the one side were the German angels and the devils on the Allied side. International politics is a messy business. It's mainly to show, though, that the effort to show that the defeated were only bad guys and the Allies were all good guys is a gross perversion of reality, to put it that way. And that history is like that. The more we step back from history, the less apt we are to say, who are the good guys and bad guys? Who are the good guys and bad guys when Caesar went into Gaul? Who are the good guys and bad guys between the Carthaginians and the Romans? Well, I mean, these are matters of state and so forth. But if we're going to have any standards, let's apply them equally to all the sides and not engage in the hypocrisy of saying it's a crime when you do it, but it's okay when I do it. And to bring it up to the present, certainly by the standards of the Nuremberg Tribunal, any number of American, British, and other leaders should be treated as war criminals. Most obviously, to my mind, comes George W. Bush and Tony Blair for planning and organizing the invasion of Iraq in 2003.
Under false pretenses.
Of course,
they lie to the populace.
Right.
They lie to other leaders. They lie to the entire world and manipulated NATO into declaring war in Afghanistan, manipulated this coalition of the willing into invading Iraq. We are very woke on the Tony Blair question here on the Writer's Block.
Right.
I recommend people also watch Academic Agents streams on Tony Blair, whom he calls rightfully the Dark Lord. He usually does a Dark Lord watch because Tony Blair, he's still slithering around. He's involved in Central and Sub-Saharan Africa, the Sahel region, I believe. And he also appears to be, how do I put this? The vaccine tyranny's man on the ground in the United Kingdom. So never lose sight of Tony Blair. He's one of these snakes that probably won't go away until we actually gain political power. So, yeah.
Well, with regard, it is refreshing to see that there is a pretty broad consensus in Europe that Tony Blair was not a good guy, and even in Britain, he's held in a pretty wide contempt. When I was in Britain, England, London several years ago, before I was banned from the country, I visited the...
You're banned from the United Kingdom?
I'm banned from the United Kingdom. There's a lot about that on our website, too, if you care to look. But anyway, when I visited the home, burly policemen or soldiers are standing outside of his home on this square in London with these big, hairy automatic weapons, and they have police cars to guard him. And this alone, I think, says something about modern British society and about Tony Blair, that he's has to be protected from bombing or assassination. But what's worse, though, is that here in the United States, that kind of opprobrium, that kind of contempt is not given to George W. Bush, who is even more responsible than Tony Blair. Because in America, there's this feeling, well, if their intentions were good, or after all, they're American presidents, we have to be respectful. This is, of course, a very American thing. If the intentions, or at least the public intentions, are more important than what they actually do. There was a huge amount of goodwill given to Colin Powell when he died recently. Well, he lied. He was a major figure in the Bush administration, lying to the world to justify the invasion of Iraq. But people say, well, he was a good guy. He was a nice guy. He was nice to other people. That may all be true. Hermann Göring, by all accounts, was a pretty nice guy, too. He was a pretty friendly, jovial guy in personal life.
Yeah, he appears to be one of these ultra bombastic people that are just the life of the party.
Right.
Classic type A personality.
Right. Yeah,
that's what they call him.
Almost
all. You know, he was a fighter ace. The classic alpha male. Right. Hermann Göring, very, very interesting persona. I do these, dime store personality tests, and I always get, which Nazi leader are you most familiar with in personality? And I always get Göring. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. It means I'll probably become addicted to some horrible methamphetamine or something.
Well, he was unquestionably a very intelligent man. His father had been the German governor in Southwest Africa, which is now Namibia. He was brave. He was the outstanding fighter pilot in the First World War. He took over after Baron von Richthofen was killed. By all accounts, he was no dummy. And he was also, people said, enormously fun guy. I mean, people liked him as an host when foreign guests would come in and so forth. But see, that's not important. The important thing is what he did. I mean, as his policies, that's more important than his personality. My only point is that whether Colin Powell was nice to children or not doesn't cover up the fact that he lied and knowingly lied. And he other people told him. I met recently with a man who had been in the CIA who resigned in 2003 because he learned from other CIA agents that Colin Powell was lying. I mean, at the time, yeah, it was known to people that what he was saying was not true. And he was so outraged. But not many people did. And Colin Powell could have actually probably prevented the war if he had publicly resigned and protested about it. But he didn't. He didn't. Anyway, the bigger point is the Nuremberg trials are an example of what many historians have called victor's justice. The winners write the rules. The winners get to set the agenda. And that works for a while. But in the long sweep of history, that isn't going to last. And it's breaking down increasingly now. I mean, even some of the countries, you might say, that were involved in the Nuremberg enterprise don't exist anymore. The Soviet Union is gone. It's a thing of history. The British Empire is gone. Britain's role in the world is very, very different than it was at the end of the Second World War. And America's role is changing. In fact, increasingly, leaders of what they call the greatest generation that won the Second World War, they're now being denounced because they were a lot of racists and they were bad guys, too. And in the longer sweep of things, it's all going to come out in the wash, as they say. But the Nuremberg trials played this major role in solidifying this narrative. We're the good guys. They're the bad guys to justify. And out of all of this, by the way, after the Second World War was over, it was essentially the Americans that established what is now the Federal Republic of Germany. It's essentially the product of the United States. And as many German leaders have proclaimed over and over, the entire justification of the German Federal Republic lies in its denunciation of the previous German regime. The Federal Republic only has legitimacy insofar as it shows that the previous government, which was certainly more popular than this one, was bad, bad, bad. America's good. And it's one of the reasons why Germany, the German Federal Republic today, is even more harsh, you might say, in oppressing dissent and dissident views than any other state in Europe, because it goes against the very essence of what the German Federal Republic is. And in fact, the European Union, the European Union openly proclaims that Europe is defined not by heritage, not by race, not by ethnicity, not by religion, but by its adherence to liberal democracy. And the German federal, basic law, the kind of constitution
Grundgesetz.
Of the Republic, it proclaims right at the beginning, liberal democracy is the foundational worldview, foundational ideology. And that worldview is unrealistic, unhistorical. To say that if Hungary or any European state adopts policies that are not or rejects liberal democracy, it's no longer part of Europe is ludicrous. It's absurd. It's like saying that Shakespeare isn't really a European because his views were not liberal democratic views, or that liberal democracy, modern Europe has more in common with Botswana because I guess it's a liberal democracy than it does with Hungary or Russia or so forth. It's all right. It's completely unhistorical, but it's based upon an arrogance that was also manifest in the one-sided, self-righteous way that the Allies brought and executed German leaders after at the Nuremberg in the Nuremberg trial process.
And the interesting thing is that in the long run, while indeed Germany was humiliated and declared guilty and her leaders were executed, well, those that the Allies could get their hands on at least, and not Goering. Goering gave them the slip in the final instance because he committed suicide with a cyanide capsule. And of course, the Federal Republic of Germany was imposed upon the German people, and then, you know, merged with the DDR with the Deutsche Demokratische Republik in the East in 1989. And if you read German language media, they're not just repudiating the Third Reich, they're also repudiating Imperial Germany and increasingly Germany's pre-imperial past.
Right.
They're essentially only two good German states are allowed to exist, will be allowed to exist. The current one, the Weimar Republic, and maybe the East Germany, Deutsche Demokratische Republik, will be given an honorary mention. But more to my point, after this absolute and resolute defeat of Germany and humiliation of the German people and execution of their leaders and a position of infinite guilt upon the German people, what profit can the victors show for themselves? Okay, who are the victorious nations in this Nuremberg process? Russia, America, Britain, and France. Which one of these four countries is not facing its own undoing right now? People want to say Russia, but we have had Endeavor and we have had Riley Wagaman on this show, and at best I can say that Russia is 20 years behind schedule in the dissolution. And there is still a sort of kind of confidence left in some of the older Russians. But in France, in Britain, and in America, people can no longer stand up to defend even the most anodyne type of heritage that these nations can have. Mm-hmm. If you are British, the only thing you're allowed to be patriotic about are only two things: the defeat over Germany and the National Health Service, and that's it. You know, this is completely absurd. I know in America that you're being forced to take down your national heroes, not just the Confederates. Now they're coming for the unions, the Union people, the founding fathers. I know they set fire to the elk statue in Portland. I mean, the sheer absurdity of burning an elk statue. Who the hell could be offended by an elk? I know you are from Portland, so that probably hits very close to home. And
I was going to say, I'm touched that you bring that up. I grew up in Portland. I know Portland very well. My father did, his father, my grandfather in Portland, and his brother owned an important business. My father was a deputy DA, and he was also a newspaper journalist in Portland. I know downtown Portland very well. And yeah, the destruction of that very touching statue of this elk, it used to be a fountain for watering horses when it was first built, is just a good example of the mindlessness of what is called anti-fascism, carried out by so-called anti-fascists, the Antifa. And the destruction was just so mindless and nihilistic and stupid. Again, they're given a break because their intentions are supposedly on the right side of history, to use a phrase that's often used. But that does touch me in Portland, particularly, a city that within 2 years has gone from being one of the most envied cities in America to being one of the most pitied cities in the United States. It's especially meaningful for me in that way. But yeah, so I'm pleased that you brought up that particular thing. But that's just one. I mean, that's just many, a example.
Many, many friends of the show are from the Pacific Northwest. And I myself, for some strange reason, I think this is, even though I've never been to America, from what I've seen and heard, I think it would be my favorite part of America, just climate and terrain wise, because it's similar to what I'm used to, I could say.
Well, the climate of the Pacific Northwest is most similar to that of Northwestern Europe, actually. I mean, it gets rainfall from the ocean and it's lots of trees and so forth. Right.
So, yes. And like I said, a lot of friends of this show are from the Pacific Northwest. And I just saw this on Twitter last year. Well, it's not last year. It was the year before last, 2020. When BLM was rampaging through American cities, and you see them destroy the statue of an elk, and of course, before that, they scribbled racist fish on the statue of the Little Mermaid in Copenhagen Harbor, in Denmark. But this was just another level of nihilism, of just destruction for destruction's sake. Who could possibly be offended by an elk? By a statue of an elk. At this point, I had known this for a long time, but I thought to myself, at this point, you realize these people are not just ideologically misguided. It's not even the drugs they're probably taking. This is evil. This is evil. This is just this degree of pettiness towards things which are supposed to evoke thoughts of beauty. Destruction of art is really a low activity. That's all I'm going to say. And yeah, if you would like to fill the air there, Mark, I'm going
I want to make a point about Germans have, since the end of Second World War, been subjected to a big campaign of what's called re-education, of coming to grips with the past. They're supposed to come to terms with it, which means you're supposed to denounce it. You're supposed to say, we're different. We're a new kind of people and so forth. And that's led to, of course, drastic changes in architecture and so forth, all these other changes. Americans are now going through something like this, and Americans don't like it. But they have very little reason to complain, considering that Americans have overwhelmingly approved this process in Germany over a period of 80 years. They don't like it when it's applied to their country, but they approved it and applauded it when it applies to those bad Germans. Well, that same kind of finger-pointing, righteous, self-righteous way of indicting whole regimes and societies of the past is one that's now taking place here in the United States and also in Europe, even in Britain. Right. It's just ironic to me that Woodrow Wilson, the United States, and Winston Churchill are now under criticism in these countries, not for mainly, I think, the reason they should be criticized, but because they were quote unquote racists. Well, that was true in a sense. They did a lot of other things that were actually policies that were very, very destructive, but even they can't measure up to the new standards that are now obligatory in Britain and the United States and Western Europe.
Do you think that Roosevelt is ever going to be attacked as a racist? Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
That's hard, because if he wasn't good, then the whole Second World War looks like no, there was no good guys on the Allied side either, because very few people are going to defend Stalin. It's hard to defend Churchill, not least because you can never get a real idea of what he really did believe. He was all over the map about things. Roosevelt,
I think Edward Dutton is right when he says this guy, if he was not a full psychopath, then he was definitely close to it. Well, about Churchill.
I don't want to engage in a psychological
psychologizing.
Analogy, but the big point is Churchill betrayed.
Can actually do it with Churchill because he was so impressed with it, with himself, that he wrote about himself constantly. So we actually do have a good insight into what he was thinking about on a daily basis, assuming obviously that he told the truth. Now, obviously, there is some embellishment there, but this is something that I don't like, you know, diagnosing people from afar as well. But in some cases, you can make an exception when their inner lives are well documented. And usually this is with people who are narcissistic enough to think that their inner lives are so interesting, they need to be put on paper, which definitely, definitely fits Churchill.
Well, he's guilty of more than that. I mean, I think narcissistic is not an inappropriate way to describe him. He did say, of course, that history will be very kind to me because I'm going to write the history. And he made his best effort. He wrote a 6-volume history of the Second World War, in which, of course, he portrayed himself in a very flattering way. And that his narrative of the Second World War has been, at least for a long time, widely accepted. But as I said, he was all over the map. So he was very pro-Soviet, very anti-Soviet. He was very much in favor of democracy. He was very much in favor of the British Empire. It's hard to know. I mean, the only through line in Churchill is what's good for Winston Churchill. And certainly in 1938-39, the only way that he could return to power was by agitating for war, because without a war, his career was finished and had been finished for many years. And so he was a person who, as many historians and other people who knew him well, reveled in war. He liked war. And that alone is something. But he's not criticized today for that. Now in modern Britain, his one great sin is that he was a racist. Well, yeah, that's true. That's true as well. And so by today's standard, already he's just beyond the pale. I mean, a lot of other people would say that his sins were far greater of policy in ways that were more concrete and specific. And Woodrow Wilson, too, sent Americans off to die and to kill in a crusade that was mindless and stupid. But the deaths of all those people matter less than the fact that Woodrow Wilson was reimposed segregation in the Washington, D.C. bureaucracy. He was certainly a white supremacist, if you will. And that's alone enough to condemn him, not the policies that actually led to deaths and destruction and ruin in Europe. That's less important than the fact that he was held these very unfashionable views by today's standards about race. But my point is, this is all nihilistic because the standards that we're now supposed to uphold in America and Western Europe mean we're going to reject almost all of human history. Whether it's Aristotle, Shakespeare, Confucius, there's no end to it. It's going to be like a Savannah Roll, the bonfire of the vanity. We're going to be destroying a whole lot of books and art, or at least shunning it. I'm amused, for example, about all the criticism they say of what they called Nazi art produced during the Third Reich. Well, the criticisms they make of it are the criticism you could make of the art of the ancient Greeks. You could make the same criticism of art throughout the ages, that it's idealistic and that it tries to be beautiful, it tries to be symmetry and so forth. All those criticisms that are made of the art of the so-called bad Third Reich are the same criticisms you make of the great art heritage of Western, not only the Western world, but of all of human history. Anyway, this is my point, is that Nuremberg helps set us on the road, you might say, to where we are today, a hypocrisy, a double standard, a refusal to face reality, that has led to where we are today, trying to make a society that is more than utopian. It's actually kind of lunatic. And all efforts in human history to try to make a society that's not in accord with reality, with history, with how human beings really are, is doomed. And a lot of people will pay a very high price in breakdown and destruction that we're seeing increasingly all around us in Europe and the United States today.
Great. To your point that what is being done to America and Britain right now, that certain Americans and English supported when it was done to Germany, but they oppose it now, that, yeah, it's okay if you do it to those Germans, but not okay if you do it to us. This is sadly another feature of human nature. I've noticed this in my interactions on Gab with people who are, let's say, conservative and freshly banned off Twitter, and they are often, you know, complaining about how the tyranny has gotten to them, how they're being prosecuted for this or that reason. And I say to them, look, we in the dissident right have been prosecuted, you know, by the law, not just by private companies, but by the state itself, for so long, and you people did not care a bit. You didn't care at all. Now that it has happened to you, suddenly it's a bad thing. Now you realize this. And people simply will not care about a problem happening to some people over there, unless it touches them directly. They're now complaining about the imposition of critical race theory through the federal government. Kennedy integrating the Southern universities at gunpoint using the American military, or was it Eisenhower? I don't remember. It was one of those two presidents. Yeah, it was Eisenhower, right? Integrating the Southern colleges at gunpoint. No, that was okay because that's racism. Now, well, what's really the difference? They're both imposing this worldview upon you. It's just you claim not to be racist. That's the difference. That's not going to stop you.
You're making a very good point. I've made the point in similar ways many, many times that conservatives, precisely because they don't really pay attention to things that are happening until it affects them personally, finally complain when it's too late. That is, both conservatives and liberals have for years supported this principle of, well, we have to create this egalitarian society. It wasn't a Democrat or a left-wing extremist who first introduced affirmative action. It was Richard Nixon. And the entire premise of affirmative action is that, well, some whites are not going to get a job or they're going to be fired to put in a black person who might be less qualified because whites as a collective are responsible for the fact that there's this great disparity or gap between how blacks and whites live. Yeah. This was also proclaimed by President Lyndon Johnson when he was president. And both Nixon and Johnson got the votes of the majority of white Americans. But Americans hear that and they think, okay, well, that's nice, whatever. But it's not until the policies based on those principles begin affecting them in their daily lives, in their own neighborhoods, that they finally start objecting. Well, by that time, it's too late. Ronald Reagan, who was a darling, I guess, of conservatives, he would proclaim, well, America is a country for everyone in the world who believes in freedom. And people who try hard to get to their country, they really believe in freedom. And he gets a lot of applause from people who call themselves conservative. Well, the actual consequence of embracing that principle is going to mean millions of people are going to be coming into the United States from everywhere from Somalia to Syria. But conservatives give support to principles that sound good, and then they object when the impact of the policies based on those principles affects them in their own neighborhoods. Critical race theory. I mean, You'll hear a lot of conservatives call it Marxist. Well, it's not Marxist by any logical stretch of the imagination. They use that word as an epithet in the same way that many leftists use the word fascist in this very loose way.
We had an actual Marxist here on the writer's block to explain to me. Basically, it veered off into all sorts of strange discussions. But even though I do not agree with Marxism's premises, you can be 100% sure that modern race hustling is really only orthogonal to Marxism. If there is any reason to call it Marxist, it's because it came from a Marxist, and that's Leon Trotsky. The entire concept of racism comes from Trotsky. But then there is an argument to be made that Trotskyism veers so far out from Marxism that it's a completely new school of thought related to the other one only genealogically at this point, especially modern Trotskyism. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah. Digression. You're getting a little. But my bigger point is that conservatives object to critical race theory, but the premise of critical race theory, one of the premises, is that America was founded by white men who wanted this to be a white republic. That's in fact true. That's in fact the case. And critical race, many of these conservatives want to pretend that Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and John Adams were just forerunners of Martin Luther King or of George W. Bush or even Donald Trump. That's completely inaccurate. It's not true. America was founded by people who wanted this to be a white republic. And many, many conservatives don't want to acknowledge that. In fact, it's astonishing that many people who call themselves conservative now say they're the real inheritors of the legacy of Martin Luther King, that Martin Luther King was a Republican and we're not racists. The real bad racists are those Democrats, because the Democratic Party was a segregationist party for a long time. Well, that's all true, but highly misleading and inaccurate. And oftentimes I say to conservatives, or I'll ask a conservative, what is it you want to conserve exactly? And they have a hard time answering that question, except a vague reference to freedom. Of course, by freedom, they mean freedom for themselves. They don't seem to really care if Detroit is an unlivable place, or if things are bad in Chicago, or things are falling apart, as long as they're not affected. If they're living okay, they don't seem to really care very much. They talk about America or Americans, but they don't really seem to care much about Puerto Ricans, who are also U.S. citizens. They really think very much in terms of, is America good for me? And if it's good for me, then this is a great country. If it's not good for me, then I don't like it. But if it's not a good society, if there's lots of problems in it, they don't really care, or they don't really do much about it, as long as the problems don't affect them in their own daily lives. And this is part of the reason why history is important, and why looking at history in a larger way, because the policies and the ideology of a society are going to have consequences ultimately even for the individuals in that society. And one of the great delusions of many Americans is that they can give support to premises and principles and worldview that are wrong or not based on reality, and that there's not going to be any consequence for them in their own personal lives. And that's a very, very big delusion, and underscores the importance of understanding and learning from history. And I mean history as it really is. So that in today's America, not merely leftists or liberals or Democrats or people who call themselves that, but also people who call themselves conservative or Republican are equally delusional, I think, about their view of American history and world history. They seem to think that the Second World War was a great triumph for America. That was a wonderful thing. Well, it's true. Out of the Second World War, America emerged as the dominant power in the world. But that wasn't because we were better or smarter or more enlightened than other countries. It was because the rest of the world had been destroyed in the Second World War. The rest of the world was on its back. And many Americans think that American hegemony and dominance, even economically in the world, was somehow the norm based on because we're such a smart, good, righteous people. But that world is gone. It's not coming back. It was based on a temporary thing. At the end of the Second World War, something like 90% of the automobiles made in the world were made by the big three automakers of Detroit: Chrysler, General Motors, and Ford. Today, every year, China produces more automobiles than the United States and Japan combined. And just this past year is the first time in history that Toyota, a foreign automobile manufacturer, produced more automobiles or sold more automobiles in the United States than any than General Motors or any American company.
Is that so? I thought they were number one for years now.
What, Toyota?
Yeah.
Well, not in the United States. Last year is the first time. In California,
I think globally, Toyota has been number one for at least 10 years.
I'm talking about here in the United States. I'm talking about only in the United States. But the point is that the world, the temporary aberrant world of the 50s, 60s, 70s, when the rest of the world, Europe, Russia, China, were on their backs, were destroyed, that world has gone. And the United States' place in the world inevitably has changed. And wise leaders will take into account that reality, that this world has not changed. But I'm very concerned that men like both Trump and Biden, who grew up in the 50s or so, or came to age in those times in the 60s, they somehow want to return to those days when America could snap its fingers and countries will do what we want them to do. Those days are not coming back. And especially this is a ludicrous delusion coming from a country or the leaders of a country that can't even get our own act together. We have so many very, very serious problems in this country. But anyway, that's a larger thing because these people don't look at history. They look at the world in terms of good guys and bad guys, and they start with the premise that we're the good guys. It's a little bit like a comic book view of history or the world. Superman's a good guy. How does he prove he's a good guy? He's always fighting bad guys. So we always fight bad guys. We find bad guys to fight. That's a very, very simplistic, but it accords with how the mass of people, particularly in America, I think, look at things because the complexity of international relations, just like human relations, are too difficult for most people to really want to deal with in any serious way.
Right. I think this obsession with being the good guy and American preeminence in the middle of the 20th century proving this. I've heard this repeated to me by a lot of conservatives and libertarians that, well, if your alternative system is so good, right, and here they accuse me of being a fascist, then why did your people lose and why did we win, right, in the war? And first of all, this is just asinine, but let's go with it for a while. But in it, I detect the hint of this Calvinist doctrine of predestination and of manifest grace. And as we know, Calvinism really lies at the root of the American self-conception, Puritan Calvinism, really, that certain people are elect, and you can never really be sure who are the elect, but you can sort of kind of make it out because God will bless them with prosperity and long life and victory in battle. And I think that a secular version of this belief persists in America's self-image, and particularly the self-image of American conservatives, when they say, America, we are the good guys. And how do we know this? Well, look at how rich we are, you know, because why would God bless an evil people with this massive wealth that we have? Why would God give us victory in the Second World War? And this is why I think a lot of Americans had a lot of trouble recognizing that America lost the war in Vietnam. This is why, even at this late stage, Americans had problems admitting that America lost in Afghanistan in 2021, that the withdrawal was not... I mean, the kind of things I heard that actually it was a strategic withdrawal and we just dumped a bunch of weapons on China's doorstep and, oh, it was five-dimensional chess. I think it's because of the self-conception that if we lose a battle, we lose our legitimacy. And it's the same thing with wealth, the same thing that this is another thing why another reason why I think America is very fragile right now to all sorts of pressure, because if plenty were to be disrupted in America, it would undermine this legitimacy of God has blessed us with this great bounty, therefore we are the good guys. And you can see this if you read, I recommend everyone read this book, because it's a book of history, but it's also a book of anthropology and culture and sociology. David Hackett Fisher's Albion Seed, Four British Folkways in North America, and they really get into the psychology and really the culture of America, of early America, which has carried on into today's America. You see this Calvinist notion that, yeah, if we are wealthy and long-lived and have victory, it means we are the elect. And that's something to think about. Of course, I'm not one of these people who thinks Calvinist Puritans are running America and they're to blame for everything. But there is something to that notion that the prevailing ethos of the American empire is, you could say, it's not even just Protestant, it's specifically Calvinist Puritan. Anyways, we have questions from the audience. Would you mind answering a question on American politics, Dr. Weber? I'm sure not. Okay. Gentlemen, what do you think about using the Groyper strategy for midterm candidates? For example, using census figures to make them publicly acknowledge the great replacement at the town hall. Is it worth to even try? That is from Gadius Maximus for $25. Dr. Weber?
I'm not sure what the Groyper strategy or ploy is.
It would entail walking into a public event and asking an uncomfortable question of the speaker. It's a reference to, I don't know if you heard of the Groyper Wars, but Turning Point USA events, they were basically dissident adjacent people went in there and started asking very uncomfortable questions of Charlie Kirk, who's this conservative youth outreach person. They asked him questions like, the most iconic one was, why is he platforming so many gay people on his events? How does anal sex help us win the culture war? It was actually a pretty good. It wasn't just making fun of Charlie Kirk, although that was a big bonus. It forced him to move to the right. It really forced the mainstream GOP to deal with these questions when they wanted to shove him under the rug. So it's essentially walking into a public event, asking an uncomfortable question of the speaker. And what I think Gaudius is asking is, can we influence candidates for Congress by doing this?
I think anything that raises awareness and gets people to think is good, all to the good. A prerequisite, really, for any real success, and I don't mean just winning elections, but I mean really changing things, has to be to tell the truth, you know, or to force people or to do anything to get people to tell the truth. I mean the truth in a larger way about realities of human society and so forth. But yeah, anything like that, I suppose, might be good. But I do caution that I'm skeptical of those people who think that this tactic or that administration or this person or this particular thing is going to change things. When I was younger, I used to think that there was a point at which Americans would finally wake up or react to what's going on. But I've been astonished at the tendency, the willingness of millions of Americans to put up with ever new and ever more outlandish humiliations and outrages that's going on in our society. And the attitude of many Americans is, well, how do I get out of this? I'll move to another place. I'll just move somewhere else where it's better. I'll even leave the United States. That's a very American idea that the really important thing is what's going to be in for me. And the unwillingness of people to draw any larger social conclusions from all of this. In other words, the problem isn't that a lot of people aren't aware of all of these things, is they don't draw any real practical consequences or conclusions from this awareness. That's, to me, the bigger problem. And so embarrassing Kirk or making a point in a public lecture, this should be obvious and to a lot of people, but we have very, very few leaders that are willing to state openly, clearly, unambiguously, a lot of realities about history, race, about society, and so forth. That's a bigger problem. And it's not a question of pushing this or pushing that person. It's really an unwillingness to be very frank and open. I want to go back to this point you made earlier about, I know about Albion Seed, and of course the Puritan Pilgrim legacy. That's less important, I think, than just the reality that people came to this country from other countries as individuals to better themselves as individuals. That has always, this individualistic outlook has always been very, very important in American history. It's not so much due to religion. I think it's due to just the reality of why people came here and then the unwillingness to really come to grips consequentially with America as a larger society. But that's breaking down. I would sum up what you're saying in the way that Americans think good guys win wars, bad guys lose. Good guys win, bad guys lose. That's a very American idea. That doesn't come from religion. That comes from the fact that when people came to this country in the 17th, 18th, even the 19th centuries, America was a country of immense bounty, huge resources available there essentially for the taking. And so it seemed, because of the reality of American life, that outlook was justified. Things did go better. Everybody did better, or not every, but almost everybody did much better than they did. Already when America was founded, white Americans lived better than anybody else in the rest of the world, much better than Europeans. Land was free. We had huge forests. We had all these opportunities. And Americans took that for granted. They see that as an example of God's providence that Americans are so good. Now, about war, winning the wars, you cited Afghanistan, Vietnam, but even in the Second World War, the country that did the most killing and dying and sacrifice in the Second World War wasn't the United States, it was the Soviet Union. And naturally, Stalin and the Soviet leaders saw the outcome of the Second World War as a validation of their system. They saw their victory in the Second World War as proof of the superiority of the Soviet way of life. And Americans like to forget that the country that actually had armies in place and did more killing of the Germans than anyone else, the Soviet Union, was a victor in the Second World War. Because you'll hear all sorts of Americans talk about how we won the Second World War. Well, as the Nuremberg process showed, the Soviet Union was an equal regarded by the United States as a worthy partner. So right. It was actually, and you could say the United States saved the Soviet Union in the Second World War. But nobody today thinks that the outcome of the Second World War proves the vitality and the greatness of the Soviet way of life. And Americans are increasingly hard pressed to try to say that the outcome of the Second World War shows the superiority of the American way of life, because the last 20, 30 years have been very, very disappointing, I'll put it that way. Not only have we lost one war after another or failed to achieve our victory, our goals in these wars, but people all around can look around and see that life in America and American society is in very, very bad shape. And so you'll find people who call themselves conservatives saying, well, we need a president who can make America great again. At the same time, they'll say, this is the greatest country of all. They'll say both things at the same time. It's still the greatest country. Well, why is it great? Why do we need to elect someone who's going to make it great again if it's the greatest country in the world? They're very confused. And almost all Americans, overwhelmingly, are unable to really answer, how did we get into this situation? If America was so wonderful, what went wrong? And I go back to the column that just appeared the other day in the New York Times by David Brooks. America's falling apart, and he tries to answer the question, well, what went wrong? He says, I don't know. I don't know what the problem is. The problem is America's been on a trajectory for decades that's based on false premises. It's the policies and the worldview pushed by newspapers like the New York Times have got us inevitably into this situation. And that's very difficult, of course, for David Brooks and the New York Times to acknowledge, impossible probably. And it's also hard for conservatives to acknowledge that we've been
David Brooks, the token conservative at the New York Times.
Right, right. But the bigger point is there's a widespread awareness that things are not going well, and neither conservatives nor liberals in America can offer any kind of coherent, logical explanation, except there's bad guys out there causing problems of how we got into this situation. How can a society so good get so bad? They don't have a good answer to that. And that's why only an understanding of history helps us to understand how America got into the situation today and why no single administration or policy or leader is going to turn that around as long as there is not a drastic rethinking about how we look at ourselves and the world and of history.
Ultimately, I think that this may not be even possible, because this is something I've been thinking about a long time. Whence does psychologically and sociologically the phenomenon of conservatism, for example, come from? And I think it comes from a place of an inability to grasp the nature of the situation. It comes from a place of being faced with a novel problem for one which is not prepared, and also when one does not have the capacity to develop new solutions, only to implement already developed procedures for a certain category of problems. And here, I think the problem is also this character trait of conservatives, which I've observed before, that they value hard work and perseverance a lot more than out-of-the-box thinking. So when they're faced with a problem for which they do not have a solution, they will try to use it. They will try to use old solutions which do not work. And when they do not work, they will just implement them harder once again. And eventually they get stuck on a loop. You explain to these people that the system is rigged, then now there is obvious vote stealing and election rigging, and what is their solution? Well, we got to vote harder, and we got to own the libs on Twitter. Well, you're getting banned on Twitter. We got to own the libs on Twitter harder. We got to debate harder. It's like they lack the capacity to step out of this perpetual outrage machine and start coming up with novel solutions, or maybe just crack open a history book and see if anyone in history has solved this category of problem. Because that's the thing you learn when I was a lawyer for about 6 years, and Mrs. Gilvey, she's a programmer. One of the first thing you learn in these professions is you don't have to reinvent the wheel. Somebody probably faced a similar problem to yours in the past. It's often far easier. This is my reading of history, right? We are not a new species. We have been around for a long time. We have written records. We have faced similar problems during the decline of the Roman Empire, the Roman Republic, the decline of the Byzantine Empire, the Ottoman Empire, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these are not new things which are happening in the world. They are very old things. They have old solutions, but sometimes you cannot really solve them. Sometimes you can. The only thing you can really do is just. Julius Evola said, "Ride the tiger." I was going to say more like surf the wave, but yeah, ride the tiger is as good a phrase as any.
To go to a couple of points. One of the reasons that this is so difficult for Americans, especially to deal with, is that unlike other countries, you're in Macedonia. Macedonia has had a very colorful run of history for the last 200 years. It's been had different flags, different currencies, parts right. of Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, claimed in a way by Greece. I mean, it's a very, very checkered history.
Yeah, it's very hard for me. Like the local manifestation of the Nuremberg paradigm tries to shoehorn everything into this good guys versus bad guys thing, which is not unique to America. It's also very prevalent in Russia as well. Right. And so, for example, the Bulgarians, they were allied with the Germans and they occupied part of Macedonia. But in the Aegean part of Macedonia, which is now part of Greece, although back in the day it had a lot of ethnic Macedonians there, well, the Macedonians collaborated with the Germans against the Greeks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the local Yugo boomers, as I call them, these local people with Yugo nostalgia who are, even if they're conservative, they're constitutionally still socialists. They're trying to present this, oh, the great anti-fascist Macedonian struggle. And I say to them, well, hold on. You know, is it anti-fascist or were we just engaged in ethnic conflict with the Bulgarians on the one hand and the Greeks on the other? You got to look at these things, try to detach yourself morally from it and try to have a cool head about it. It's really not with me, even though, yes, my people fought them. I don't even want to demonize the Bulgarians or the Greeks. I just want to understand the conflict, maybe prevent such conflicts in the future because nothing good can come out of European nations killing each other again.
Right. Well,
this kind of complexity is most people want to watch a morality play unfold when they read history. The reality is it's just it's not that simple.
Well, I appreciate what you said, and the Macedonian history is a fascinating subject. The bigger point I was trying to make, though, is that the United States, unlike Italy, France, Germany, Belgium, many other countries, China, and so forth, the United States has lived under the same flag, the same currency, nominally the same constitution for 230 years or so. And Americans, for that reason, see a kind of continuity. There might be changes, there might be things, but superficially, there's been a great continuity to American history over the past 200 years. That's not true in Europe. It's not true in much of Asia. Japan lost the Second World War, was occupied. Germany went through all sorts of changes. Italy, even. France went through different republics and forms of government. And Americans have not undergone anything like that. So there's a tendency, a very strong tendency, to think that any change has to be some version, some revision of basically what we already have. It's very, very hard for Americans to imagine a state with a completely new flag, a new currency, a new whole form of government. That's very hard for Americans to envision because we haven't had those kinds of experiences. So that's one of the reasons why, especially those people who call themselves conservatives, it's very difficult for them to talk about really radical change and radical thinking. And for liberals, too, they see a continuity of America becoming ever more egalitarian. They see this as a long-term trend, and they're just asking or demanding the next step in this process, as they see it, of reaching an ever more equal universalist society. So, but anyway, those two narratives are in play, but they're both based on the idea that the only real change is some version of what we have today. Now, you made a reference earlier, and it's an important one, that what America is going through today isn't some new chapter in American history. It means a drastic change, something like the end of the Ottoman Empire, the end of the Roman Empire, the end of the Roman Republic, something that drastic. And I think particularly we can learn from the example of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was a multicultural, multilingual, multi-religious empire that endured for centuries and seemingly well, in a sense. Macedonia was part of it for centuries. But as it began breaking down at the end of the 19th, the beginning of the 20th century, and finally under the pressures of the First World War, what arose from that were nation states. Turkey became a nation state, not an empire. And it was the kind of genius or insight, you might say, particularly of one man, Kemal Atatürk, who made the new Turkish Republic on a basis that has proven remarkably durable over time. It wasn't a Yugoslavia, it wasn't the Soviet Union, it was a Turkish Republic, and it's endured, and it's doing rather well, I think. But the point is, it's
stable, right?
That kind of thinking is necessary, I think, in America today. A radically different outlook about the future than some version of what we've had. And so that's why I get a little impatient when people talk about, well, a Groyper strategy or Donald Trump or how we're going to win the 2024 elections. All that to me is it's rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. The ship is going down. We need to get out the lifeboats. We have to think about how we're going to get to the shore, what we're going to do from here. That's the only way, because all the rest of it is really just piddling around the edges. It's not dealing with the fundamental reality that the America that we've had for many, many years is dying. In fact, the America really of the founders is long dead, long past. And the America of the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, that is never coming back. And so it requires a radically different, fundamentally different way of looking at ourselves and our future.
It's I think what Gadius was getting at was not that we can win elections with this group strategy, but rather insert these ideas into the discussion by asking questions about them. And that's even more important than winning elections.
Right, but even inserting those questions only shows the hypocrisy or the lack of ambiguity of our time. It's really more important to do much more, to ask more fundamental questions. Is a multiracial society even viable? Can it exist? I mean, that's a more fundamental. The founding fathers did not believe that blacks and whites could live together in the same society on anything like the basis of equality or tolerable relationship. They that's what they thought. Americans today, who call themselves conservative, somehow think that's possible. They don't live that way in their daily lives, but they say that that's what they want, or they pretend that that's what they want. The point is only a very, very radical coming to grips with these very basic questions is the only way to really deal with the enormous and growing crisis of our time.
Well, yeah, that's a very exhaustive answer to the question. I thank you for that. I have a lot to respond to that, specifically to the issue of the Ottoman Empire. I wrote an article for Countercurrents, which is titled "For the Coming American Atatürk," where I call on America to stop hoping for a Caesar. A lot of people are talking, we need an American Caesar. I say, American Caesar came and went. His name was Lincoln. Even American Diocletian came and went. His name was Franklin Roosevelt. At this point, you don't need a Caesar. A Caesar is someone who reinvigorates the empire. What you need is someone to dismantle the empire and turn it into a nation. You need an American Atatürk. And I get a little romantic there, a lot of flowery prose, but what you gonna do? If the mods would just link that into the chat so the audience can read it at their leisure later on. And that's something to think about. Another thing about continuity you mentioned. You're right that America has continuity of state. What we have in Europe is continuity of ethnos, continuity of nation. So, for example, the French are on their Fifth Republic, right? It's the Fifth Republic. But there is zero doubt that these are the French from the time of Charles the Great. They have a continuity of people and place and, to a certain degree, language, not really. Okay, scratch language, but faith, certainly, culture, of which stretches back to, well, the late antiquity, right? You can say the same thing about Macedonians. It stretches even further back than us, although let's not get into that. I have my own theories on the subject, but and what's interesting to me, I'm not going to say that Americans don't have this, because I've read enough of Greg Johnson's writings to recognize that actually America has this continuity of people, or at least had it until it started dissolving the American people for a very long time, even predating the United States, the republic for which the flag stands. That essentially, due to the reality of transport in this time, from Jamestown to the Declaration of Independence, you could say that this was an American or a proto-American nation budding on the North American continent. Already you could see the differences between the people living in the colonies and the English, and of course the Dutch were coming in as well, some Germans as well. And so what this really convinced me that America isn't an idea which Thomas Jefferson thought up into being in 1776. It's a place and a people, and you know, there's an affinity between this place and these people, and they have a continuity in the North American continent, and this gives them legitimacy, not some rhetorical flourishes on a document written in 1776. And this is I'm going to say something very controversial. People will often say, oh, well, people will immigrate and they will assimilate. Just look at the Irish and the Italians. But if you look at America before and after the mass Irish and Italian and Jewish immigration, and sometimes even Polish immigration in the late 19th and early 20th century, we are not looking at the same countries. And of course, we see that these immigrants, they did not assimilate into America as much as they assimilated America into themselves. I mean, the Irish just took over local and state governments and basically started running a ethnic grift machine. Nothing against the Irish, but I'm just looking at history the way I see it. Would you agree with that? With that, the fundamental nature of America, as it was before this massive post-Civil War immigration wave, was changed by these people who came in, and you know, they were white people, and still they couldn't assimilate into this different culture.
When America was founded in 1776, I've been writing and talking about this just in recent weeks. The phrase "all men are created equal" didn't mean anything like what it's supposed to mean today. What Jefferson and what the people who signed that document meant first and foremost was they were rejecting monarchy. They were rejecting the notion that people should have power based on their ancestry. The King of England was King of England because his father had been King of England. Mm-hmm. They're rejecting the notion that power and authority should be based on birth. And instead, they believed it should be based on skill, ability, dedication to the common good. They wanted a white meritocracy, a white republic. They contrasted monarchic ideology with republican virtues. And that was what was meant by all men are created equal. But more than that, they all assumed and took for granted that it was to be a white country. Even Jefferson was emphatic. In fact, he worked out plans for deporting blacks from the United States because he believed they could not live together in the same kind of society on anything like equality. And he wanted to do it. But my point is, at the beginning, there was this feeling that a new people, a new folk, if you will, a new ethnicity was going to emerge from this. One of the first designs for a seal of the United States was made by a Swiss scholar, and it showed the initials of the 13 colonies around the symbols of England, Scotland, Ireland, Holland, France, and Germany. And those were supposed to show the peoples that were the origin of this new American nation. It was explicitly to be of European ancestry. Now they, this design, and then underneath was E Pluribus Unum, which is still retained as a motto, from many one. He means from many of these nations, a new nation, a people who have a common ethnicity were to emerge. That's what was implied by this. And America was, in a sense, on its way to developing this, but it never really came to grips with it. It didn't become, it wasn't explicit about this. And they still are not. In fact, today, they say just the opposite. Ethnicity, national identity, those are not important. We're all just individuals. But the founders did have that idea. And America, and there, yeah, the real challenge is developing a peoplehood, I guess. And in fact, people should be very careful when they use the word we. In America, people use the word we in different contexts. You'll hear liberals say, we should do such and such. Well, they oftentimes when Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama say we, they don't mean themselves. They mean white working people better. We better think this or we should do that. They mean somebody else should. And people use this word we very, very loosely. And when and that's one of the problems of America is that there's ambiguity about the very word we, just as there's ambiguity about what does it mean even to be American. So that the crisis of our time in America particularly is a crisis of identity. Who are we? What does it mean to be American? And unless and until that question is dealt with, there's nothing. But in the Ottoman Empire, it wasn't Kemal Ataturk and the Turkish nationalists that brought down the empire. It came down by itself under the pressure of the First World War. Kemal Ataturk was able to, from the ruins of that, make a or help guide a Turkish nationalism that was not really very strongly in place. And that's a possibility that can emerge here in America. But all of this is really in the future. For the time being, I think all we can really do is point out what is happening and to make clear that the breakdown of America, the falling apart of America, is not only something that might happen, it's inevitable, it's inexorable, because the contradictions within the American society today are so great, the contradictions between the ideology and the reality are so vast that there's no way to really make this thing work. There's no historical example of any kind of durable, multi-racial, multicultural democracy. It just never, it's never happened in history, and it's not going to happen here in America unless you want to believe that we're so wonderful, we're so great that we can defy the laws of history, which is what liberals and many conservatives seem to believe. So all we can do is try at this point. I believe that political, that the opportunities in political action are very limited during our time. They will be shot down largely because most people, most voters, most Americans don't want to accept the sacrifices that would be necessary if any real great change were to be made. They want an easy or relatively easy answer to the to dealing with the problems of our time. That's not going to happen. So that all I think that is possible right now is educational work, especially aimed at people who can and must be leaders in the future. Anything else, I think, is pretty largely a waste of time, except insofar as it raises awareness about the fundamental nature of our problems and what's necessary in the long term in the future.
It's interesting that you mentioned people who will be leaders in the future, because I think that the failure of mass appeal for distant politics in recent well, I wouldn't exactly call it a failure, but the lackluster successes we've seen from mass appeal in dissident circles may have, and of course, insights from the elite school, the Italian elite school, and from Sam Francis, James Burnham, and other people have really turned people onto an elite strategy that we win by basically cultivating a new elite, which will, when the time is right, create the framework necessary for governance. the interesting thing you know to notice about Atatürk's biography is that he and many officers of the Turkish army had been already something very resembling Turkish nationalists before the empire collapsed. They just did not have the power to make this happen. But after the empire collapsed, they were, through serendipity and a little bit through design as well, they found themselves as basically the only coherent governing body, right, which was willing to fight on behalf of the Turkish people, even though the Turkish people did not consider itself a people still, which was tragic.
Right. Well, we've seen other examples of that. Yeah, Kemal Atatürk, you said he was in the Turkish army. He was in the Ottoman army. He was an officer.
Yes, he was in the Ottoman army, right? And he was very successful at turning back Demon Churchill's assault on Gallipoli.
That's right. He became a hero for that reason. But by the same token, George Washington was an officer in the British army.
Right.
And for a time, before
that is something I wanted to discuss with you specifically regarding Nuremberg. But now that we brought up Atatürk, I'm reminded of the reconciliation plaque he installed at Gallipoli, you know, jointly with the Australian government, to show that there is no ill will between the Turkish and Australian nations. And that is something else that has been lost at Nuremberg. You could fight someone in a war.
That's right.
And then you could make peace with them and stop hating them.
Right.
Now we cannot respect our enemy.
That's
now we cannot have. It's because Nuremberg retroactively turned the Second World War into a police action. Mm-hmm. We are not fighting a war. We are apprehending criminals. It's no longer possible to respect the enemy in war. Now they are the absolute demons. They are absolute demons. They're irredeemable. They're criminals who must be thrown in jail. You cannot treat, you know, you cannot treat your enemy like Kemal Atatürk treated the Australians. With respect, with reverence, a sense of tragedy that these two nations were pitted against each other, even though they had no quarrel. It's one of those things that people don't think about when they think about Nuremberg, but it's taken from us the right to not see the enemy as a monster.
Well, I would say it's not just Nuremberg. The entire Second World War is pitted as a force good against evil, and you should be no compromise with evil. And we see that in our present day. If people are regarded as quote-unquote fascists, well, there should be no free speech for fascists. Fascists should be killed. They should be locked up. They should be silenced. We cannot allow free speech for evil people. That's what we hear in one form or another increasingly in our society, and that's already been the rule in Germany for 80 years, for 75 years, is that fascism has no place. When the Americans and the Soviets and the British planned the future of Europe, they talked about, we're going to allow democracy for all anti-fascist parties. It's only anti-fascist. As you know, Yugoslavia, which your country was once a part, it was founded first as the conference of it's an anti-fascist. Yeah. And there has to be no compromise with what they call fascism. Now, of course, it's an ambiguous term, but what it means is anyone who upholds principles which are basically eternal. They've been true throughout all of human history. And the validity of that point of view is shown by the fate of Yugoslavia and of the Soviet Union and of other multicultural political structures that fall apart ultimately under their own weight, because people as a natural thing want to live in societies of people like themselves, ruled by people who identify with them and who they can identify with. That's a very human thing, a very natural thing, a very historical thing. And to imagine that there can be this utopia or these, I mean, even in 1989, Czechoslovakia broke apart. There's two peoples that are hardly more similar than the Czechs and the Slovaks, but they finally had a divorce. And here in the United States, it's obvious, I think, to millions of people that Black America and white America are very different. And the problem is not that white people just don't think the right thing. It's an objective reality that physically, culturally, behavior, they're different. We live in different ways, watch different television shows, do all these different things. And if those kind of things should be obvious. It's more understanding this reality in history. And again, going back to an example of Ataturk, the people who may emerge may be very well people who play an important role even in the political military structure that we have here today, but they will emerge, something will emerge. Something will come out of this. It might be as chaotic as the rise of all these little kingdoms and principalities at the end of the fall of the Roman Empire, or it can be something more substantial like the rise of the Turkish Republic out of the Ottoman Empire. But in any case,
it wasn't exactly peaceful or orderly. I mean, it was messy. There was ethnic cleansing done in Anatolia by the Turkish Republic and in Greece by the Hellenic Republic. But it was ultimately for the best. Of course, it was not pleasant for anyone involved at the time. But it is the way it is.
Right. I made this point, too, in a talk I gave a few weeks ago, that at the end of the Second World War, well, first of all, I want to make your point. At the end of the First World War, the League of Nations approved a plan by the Turkish and Greek leaders to forcibly move thousands or more than a million Turks and Greeks from each country to try to produce more ethnically homogeneous societies. And something similar happened at the end of the Second World War. The leaders of the United States, the Soviet Union, and Britain agreed that the new Polish Republic that was going to be founded was going to be ethnically homogeneous, no minorities. They took the view that Poland would be a stronger state if it didn't have any non-Poles, not only white people, but not even non-Poles. And they moved millions of people, not just Germans and Hungarians, but also Belarus, Ukrainians and Poles, moved these people around forcibly to try to create an ethnically homogeneous Poland. And also the minorities were eliminated from Czechoslovakia, Hungarians and Germans. Because the Allied leaders recognized, at least on some level, that homogeneous, ethnically cohesive societies are stronger and more stable than those that are multi-ethnic and multicultural. It's an irony that the United States government, which said in 1945 and 46 and 47 that Poland should have no minorities, now insists that Poland has to accept minorities not only from other countries in Europe, but from around the world. And then also American leaders seem to think that an ethnically Jewish Israel is a desirable thing. And in 1947-48, Zionists forced, moved, shunted out as many non-Jews as they could from the area that they called called Israel. And the state of Israel openly proclaims it's the nation state of the Jewish people, not even a religion, a Jewish people. And American leaders support this. But that principle, one that they thought was fine in 1945 for Poland or 1948 and now for Israel, or good in 1919 and 1920 and 21 for Greece and Turkey, is one that they deny has any validity in modern America or modern Europe.
We have donations, Dr. Weber, and thank you for that explanation. We have donations, and Michael57DE sends us $15, and he says, "Hail Nix, hail Mr. Weber, hail the gods. Wonderful to have Mr. Weber share his knowledge with us today. 14 words. Well, 14 words to you too, Michael." And we have donations on DLive as well. Ninja Guinea E from 1001 Cuts and a Ninja Guinea from Deconstructor. Well, thank you for that, gentlemen. Thank you for those donations. We are not currently running a full intensity fundraiser on Countercurrents, but those donations are nevertheless greatly welcome. They will certainly help us when the time comes. And With that, I think we have exhausted the subject. And if you would prefer, Dr. Weber, to give us a few closing words, closing remarks.
Well, I think we've at least concluded this session. I don't think even days of talk will exhaust the subject, but
I have been exhausted, so that counts for something, I guess.
I am struck that the program began inviting a discussion about the Nuremberg trials, and it became pretty far wide ranging and far reaching here. But that's good. That's fine.
As I told you before we started the show, I like to set a topic as a general guideline. But this is a less formal show than what Greg runs on Countercurrents. It's I prefer to have it free form. Just get an interesting person on and let them share their thoughts, and if it stimulates me, if it stimulates my thought process, then I try to contribute something smart, and that's how it functions with on the writer's block generally. It's more a more relaxed show, more like think of it as we're in a salon, we're sipping coffee, and we're having a friendly, highly intellectual discussion.
Well, I want to conclude by just thanking you very much. I've enjoyed very much our discussion. I hadn't talked with you before this. I'm impressed by the historical connections and references that you make and made during our session. And I've enjoyed being on, and I thought it was stimulating and I hope enlightening and helpful to those people who are listening or watching.
Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Weber, for appearing. I want to thank you for putting up with me for these long 2 hours with my low IQ interruptions. I'm sure I contributed something good.
Yeah.
At least I want to thank everyone who donated. I want to thank our moderators, our heroic moderators, Bartleby and Gadius Maximus, for keeping the chat civil as always. I want to thank everyone who tuned in to watch, who commented in the regular chats here on DLive and Odyssey. This is all greatly appreciated. And I guess that's it. See you next week on the Writer's Block. Bye-bye, people.